Thanks so much to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Listen, Sentry understands developers. They know your code's broken, and they just want to help you fix it. Now, in a perfect world, you'd be able to test everything and test it perfectly. But we all know that writing tests is actually really difficult, and it's impossible to cover every edge case or anticipate the action of a really, really smart or really dumb user. Despite your best laid plans, your code will eventually go belly up. Now, you could rely on error reports from users, but is that really the best course of action? Not only is it a frustrating experience for them, but you'll end up with incomplete or misleading bug reports that waste the time of both support and development teams. That's why Sentry is here, to tell you all about the errors in your code before your customers have a chance to even see them. Their error reports include detailed contextual information to help you reproduce and fix the error, including a full stack trace, the commit where the line of code was checked in, and yes, even the developer to point the finger at. You can even get a breadcrumb trail that tracks the user's actions leading up to the error, so you can reproduce it without ever even contacting the user. And Sentry integrates with your deployment pipeline to track errors before they even make it to production. Sentry has first-party support for both client and server-side platforms, including a couple of DNC favorites, Vue.js, Rails, and yes, even Elixir. So head on over to Sentry.io to give it a try. They have a free developer account, which is perfect for personal projects and early-stage applications. Sentry.io. Your code is broken. Let's fix it together. I have some news. I actually saved this for on the air. You don't actually know this news yet. You're hearing it here first.
Okay.
We were supposed to record yesterday, but yesterday being Friday in recording time. But I was a little busy yesterday because as of today, I am officially a private pilot.
Applause. No, so were you taking a test last night or what was going on?
Yeah, I spent all day doing my, they call it the check ride, your practical exam.
Mm-hmm.
So all morning I spent doing, oral examination, just talking with the examiner and, you know, proving that I know what the heck I'm doing. And I definitely nailed that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, lunch break and then flying in the afternoon, which, you know, it was rough. I was nervous, but in the end, it wasn't anything to, scare her off from signing me off. So, it's pretty exciting. I started at the end of March, so it's been end of March. That's been about 9 months, about 60 different flights, lessons. So, here I am, 200 plus landings.
That's pretty cool.
And they're still crap.
200 plus.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't, yeah. I mean, I assume you haven't crashed yet because they gave you a license. So I guess we need to invest in a DNC plane now, right?
I think so. We can split the cost of that. It's fine. No big deal. We can.
Yeah, it's fine.
I'll come visit you and cross-country flights. It'll be good. You know what they say? Any landing you can walk away from is a good landing. And every landing you can reuse the airplane is a great landing.
That is true. How much do you think fuel would cost in a cross-country flight?
Let's plug in a four flight here. Let's see. So in a Cessna 172, we average about, I'll say 8 gallons per hour at about $5 a gallon. And let's see. Let's go. Okay. So from Hartford to Monterey, 2,290 nautical miles, 226 gallons. So yeah, it'd be about $1,100 just in fuel.
So,
and you know, 26 hours of flight time.
Man, it's supposed to be faster.
Yeah, there's definitely a optimization diagram for that.
Yeah.
So
that's cool, man. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm really excited to have that done. I was really stressed out about it this week, so didn't get a ton of work done because I was studying and practicing. So
thinking of getting out of the airplane or the programming gig.
Hey, you know, there's always an opportunity for a career shift to 10 years down the line. We'll see. So yeah, that's that's my update. Other than that, I've been working through my giant backlog of issues with my Nuxt application. That's all been really good. I've been banging stuff off the list, and I try to do the kind of low-hanging fruit things that more than one person has asked for, because that's just, you know, shows them that you're working on it and that you're listening to their feedback, and
mm-hmm.
and it's just steadily getting better. So I'm just going to keep plugging away at that. It's been I liked the process of, you know, just being able to make changes in this application is, of course, much easier because it's actually structured with components that I can swap in and out and change and move and reuse.
Right.
So that's just all been great. Nothing but good stuff. It's just the only thing that's negative is just the daunting size of the list, but that's only improving.
Yeah, I can feel that for sure, because that's been my story of Design Collective, is the list that seemingly never gets smaller, and it's growing slowly, but not exponentially, which I'm very thankful for. But it's just kind of, it's like dough in the corner of the room. It just kind of like keeps replicating, and it's not replicating fast enough to be alarming, but it's just continues to replicate nonetheless.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned working on Nux, and pretty quick update about DK stuff, I guess, this week is since we launched our Nux front end, we've had just a memory leak. I think we may have talked about this at one point, but I basically set up a script that watches. So when the RAM gets over 100% usage, it just restarts the dynos.
That's a great system.
Yeah. So they released an update, and I was reading through the release notes, and there was just a casual mention of RAM usage and of some things there with the SSR bundles. And so I sent it over to Paul, and Paul's like, I'm going to update us right now. And so we updated it. He shipped it. And the RAM, the memory leak stopped.
You should post this in the this graph in the show notes, because it's great. It's just like the sawtooth graph of, you know, memory, then restart, memory, restart, and now it's replaced with what appears to be a much flatter line. I still see a little bit of an upward trend, but it's definitely not the same magnitude as before. So
it's a very, very, very small upward trend. And because Heroku restarts the dynos every day, it gets to reset daily. So, I mean, it's like 20 megabyte usage increase over 24 hours.
Oh.
But compared to previously, where I think the dyno would, or the application would need to restart itself every few hours, if I remember correctly. And it's kind of a rolling thing. We had multiple dynos, so it wasn't like people would just suddenly get disconnected or anything, or their connections start failing. But just annoying nonetheless. And so that's my quick win for the week, I guess, was literally just bumping the Nux version and then having the memory leak just go away.
That's really cool. I also upgraded to Nux 2.4 just to stay on top of it, since I was doing, you know, working on it anyways. And I didn't even bother reading. Like, I read through the release notes to see if there's anything I cared about, but I had zero worries about compatibility or performance or anything. I just upgraded and clicked around, and it looked okay, so I pushed it, you know?
Because you're still in beta, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. But I mean, these updates are very incremental and very backwards compatible, right? So I just have had no issues with it in the past. I don't really expect to before another major release, so that's cool.
Yeah, and one thing that's really, I want to take a second to give props to the Nux community and the people running Chopin Brothers. But it seems like with this release, they're kind of getting more formal. So there's like a formal RFC process now. They're starting to schedule. So they're like saying a patch releases every, I think it was 4 weeks, and then minor releases every X weeks after that. So it seems like things are getting much more regimented, much more structured, much more organized, which I really, really like.
Yeah, no, the Elixir community has done that as well. I mean, they have a point release every year, you know, for better or for worse. They kind of time box themselves to 12 months, and, you know, whatever they ship, whatever they have ready to ship is ships, you know?
Yeah.
And so what ends up is happening is you get these incremental improvements that, you know, improve the system in, you know, add features and stability and, you know, improve performance, but in a very, very incremental way. So it's kind of cool. It's nice to, you know, not have to worry about it, because we have plenty of other changing, breaking dependencies to worry about every day.
Yeah, yeah. This is on Christmas, if I remember right. Is that true?
What, for Elixir?
The Elixir, yeah.
Oh, maybe. I'm not sure.
It's like a yearly Christmas release. I'm pretty sure, because I'm always on Twitter, and I always see the release. I'm like, oh, it's the holidays, guys. But anyway, yeah, that's cool. It feels like maturity. Like, things are maturing with Nux, which is great. It has, you know, the usage of it, the adoption has been growing quite a lot. The community has been growing. And so yeah, the structure is gonna be really awesome, I think. So hats off to everybody involved in those decisions and in the work on Noxt. If they somehow happen to hear this, just want them to know that I appreciate it.
Duly noted.
Yeah. Anyway, I could keep babbling for hours, as you know. Did you have any, what do you want to talk about today?
Yeah, so continuing with our two-episode streak of having topics to talk about, this one actually comes directly from user feedback. This came to us via Twitter probably a month or so ago, so it did take us a while to get to it, but it's been on the back burner. Ryan McDonough says, it'd be awesome if you had any decisions, product-wise, that you had to make recently, and how you came to your final choice. E.g., how to structure projects, Elasticsearch compared to other options. Always interested to hear other people's decision processes.
Mm.
And I thought this was interesting because he mentions two, in my mind, totally different things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
One, decision process, how to structure your project. You know, we talked a lot about that last week. Is kind of a nebulous thing that's sort of internal. It's you kind of have to make your own. It's making your own product, make your own service, right? Whereas
yep.
using, you know, Elasticsearch versus other options, that's you know, you're searching for services, you're searching for products, libraries you can rely on, right? Third-party things to help you do your work.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two very different things, but I think the, you know, the end result is the same. You're always working to improve your product. And
yeah.
the decision-making process, I think, has a lot of overlap. And so I came up with a list of some of these ideas that I thought were kind of general enough to be applicable to lots of different kind of decision-making processes in our line of work, especially. You know, I don't think it's even necessarily limited to that.
So, again, I feel like I could ramble on this for hours because it's sort of the... Maybe it's because we both kind of work for companies with small dev teams of like one or two people. And I feel like the life cycle for a decision-making process like this is just faster, or it happens more because we're directly involved in every single one of them. And it's not kind of spread across teams of people, or our changes are happening relatively quickly. But yeah, it is interesting. If you had any decisions product-wise you had to make recently, how you came to your final choice, how to structure products compared to other options. So that one seems to be like, okay, when do you decide to build something versus when do you decide to reach something? Is that kind of how you read that point?
Oh, I mean, that's definitely one aspect of it. I hadn't even thought about it that way, but I mean, that's absolutely a big decision you have to make. Do you build something versus roll your own? I think I'll touch on that in some of these things that I have listed here.
Okay.
That's a really good point though.
Yeah, no, let's take that down the road a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's jump into some of the notes you had written down.
So the first thing that came to mind, and some of these are kind of like duh things, but I think they're worth talking about and maybe expanding on a little bit. Doing research. There's so many options out there, whether it comes to, again, adopting a new technology or paying money for a platform service or even just like, you know, buying hardware, right? Buying a laptop to do work on, right? There's so many options out there. And just doing research in general, immersing yourself in whatever it is you're making a decision about, just reading a lot. A lot of people like to open browser windows with a billion tabs. That's not my personal style. I have tabs open for what I'm currently working on, but I don't like have archived, you know, windows hiding behind windows. But I like to, mm-hmm. you know, take notes, you know, get as much written down as possible, you know, bookmarks, right? You like using Notion. I keep track of things in GitHub. So if I have an idea for something and I want to research it, I'll just throw stuff into the GitHub issue, right? And I'll just edit or add links or whatever, take notes, reading, just collecting materials, you know, and whether that's documentation, whether that's reviews for that particular thing, you know, Stack Overflow issues, just learning what's out there, because it's so easy to find an option and just be like, oh, this does exactly what I need, and then use it. And
yeah,
and then yeah. You get down the road using it, and then suddenly, you learn about something else that might have been a better fit, or maybe is better supported. So
yeah, I think a lot of times too, like when you're talking about doing the research, some of that comes down to like looking at people's blog posts that they've written or seeing things that people have shared that they've done with a solution. And in a more specific case, if you're looking at, say, a design collective recently going from using Postgres plain text search to using Elasticsearch, one question might be like, why did you use Elasticsearch and not Apache Solr? You know, so part of that research involves like reading blog posts, looking at different Elixir libraries and all that stuff. And I don't know, sometimes what I do is I just look at readmes, but that doesn't really go deep enough, because a lot of times in the readmes, examples of solutions that you're looking for are kind of simplified use cases. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. Like once you get into the actual weeds, you're like, oh, this doesn't exactly do what I thought it did. Or it does something very different in a very nuanced way, which doesn't exactly work for what I need, right?
One thing you do have to be careful about is reading too much into sort of what I would consider editorialized reviews, right?
Yeah.
Things that are sort of more subjective or emotion-based. I've an example here. So when I first started using Elixir in Phoenix, I told one of my good friends about it, and he's also an engineer and developer, and he's like, I've heard really bad things about the Elixir community. I heard they're really toxic. I heard they're, kind of putting down the Ruby community and all this other like stuff. And I was like, okay, I'll keep that in mind. I'll keep an eye out for it. And if that's the case, you know, maybe this is not a good road to go down. But I mean, it's been a couple of years now. I've not seen one evidence of that. So it's like, you know, you have to sort of understand kind of where people are coming from. I mean, he probably read like one article on Hacker News, and like, you know, they love to hit on everything over there.
Oh yeah. Or comments even too.
Oh yeah, that's a exactly.
Rough place. That's a really good point. I think like the point you make, like editorialized or like highly opinionated. Another point or another thing I've noticed, especially in more recent years, is just searching for stuff is garbage, because you get either like listicles back, 10 reasons why you should use Elasticsearch over Apache Solr, or 10 reasons why whatever, or you get purely like SEO content. So it's very thin, kind of like I mentioned, some readmes can be, which is totally fine. Like that's not the point of a readme, you know, to give super in-depth analysis or explanation how something works or how to use something. But you'll get like these thinly like just barely written articles it's purely for SEO keyword content, right? Because that's part of the content strategy these days. You have to have a blog. And so the more research I do these days, you have to sludge through all that content. And I'm starting to feel like more like an important part of the step is actually breaking ground with, again, if I'm looking at Apache Solr versus Elasticsearch, maybe I should actually build time into my evaluation period to actually like write some Elixir code and see how it actually feels.
Yeah, I mean, as long as the trade-off, you know, for that isn't too much time spent, right? You don't want to make sure it's throwaway code.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'm glad you said that. Yeah, by no means I don't mean like try to finish an implementation for both. Just that's part of the exploration, is just like writing throwaway code. Like don't unit test the stuff. Don't just see. Poke around with code, poke around to see what a more specific solution might look like for you. And then once you make your decision, throw away what you had and actually start on something real.
Yeah. And part of this research process, I like to sometimes, if I'm trying to decide between a couple of specific options, you know, A, B, or C, I'll just do the stupid thing of just writing like a pros and cons list, like literally two columns. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, it seems very superficial, right? What it does is it forces you to, you know, kind of distill down what you know about the thing. It forces you to think about, you know, negatives, right? Because you're always kind of reading about positives of a certain thing, you know, but you have to think about the trade-off, what that's going to, what's going to prevent you from doing, what a certain decision will cost in terms of, you know, time and effort and complexity. So, and sometimes it's just as simple as like making those lists and just picking just quantitatively like, oh, pick the one that has the most pros, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
even if they're not equally weighted, you know, one of the pros might be like has a cool logo, right? Maybe not so valuable, but again, just going through the process and using that research to sort of lay everything on the table and just pit them against each other at a very high level.
Yeah, that's a good way to distill things down into just binary good or bad qualities for a solution. I like that. So that's got, I guess, what you're searching for, right? Is like you have to find some way to simplify things down and distill it down into some larger things that you can use to either make the decision or for or against a solution.
Yeah, and along those same lines too, besides just the positive and negative aspect, forcing yourself to attach physical numbers to things, I find it's also very, very instructive and reveals a lot.
Yeah.
And by what I mean numbers, it could be like the hours required to implement a feature. It could be the cost of a thing over a given time. It could be the number of users this will, you know, cause you to gain or lose or whatever. The number doesn't have to be right. You know, it can be a ballpark. It can be something that's completely off. Maybe the number isn't even represent a real thing, a real unit. You know, I know a lot of agile processes use like some kind of fake currency or something for like timing out things. Like this might take like 5 units of time versus something that takes 10 units of time. Well, okay, the thing that costs 10 units of time is twice as complex by whatever metric, right? But just giving hard numbers to things, you know, I found this especially useful when I was writing, you know, specifications, writing project proposals for clients, right? You've got to give them a number. You got to say, this is how long I think it's going to take. But giving them a breakdown not only gives them the information to make a decision and ask you questions like, hey, why is feature X, you know, seemingly simple feature X going to take 40 hours to build? And then maybe they decide that's not the right thing to build. They didn't realize it was so complex.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, the process of coming up with those numbers forces you to think about the time it's going to take, the complexity of the feature, back and forth time, just communicating, documenting, waiting for things to happen, right? All that stuff kind of has to get factored in. And it's tricky because that just comes from experience, but you just kind of get better with that over time, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's been one of the hardest things for me on my journey as being a developer is estimating how long something might take. I think that's one of the classic programming issues, right? Is giving an accurate feedback because it's almost never correct. But it is a really valuable thing. And that's something that we've done. I keep mentioning our spec documents that Paul and I use in Google Docs, and sometimes we'll like estimate how long the thing might take in there because that's one of the questions we will get asked. Lindsay might say, okay, that sounds great if she's signing off on an idea or a feature. When can it be done? You know, that always is appended onto her feedback. When can it be done?
It's not a surprise. It's always going to be asked.
Yeah. It's always going to be asked. Yeah. And I hear the word agile thrown around a lot, and I haven't really dug into whatever methodologies are contained, but I do like the idea of assigning some sort of currency. Like you said, this might take 1 unit of time, this might take 2 units of time. I guess at some point you need to be able to quantify that, but on the tin, right? That's kind of what you're trying to do right now, is not spend all of your time, all of your budgeted time on figuring out whether to go with A or B, but it's more quickly figuring out, is there one, if we have many, is there one that we can eliminate quickly?
Yeah. Yeah. When you compare all the different things, it can become a lot more apparent what needs to be worked on, how much time you have to work on something, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got 4 hours left on a Friday afternoon. You're not going to pick up the issue that it's going to take 20 hours to build, right? You're going to pick up the low hanging fruit.
So I'm looking over your notes here, and there was one thing that stuck out to me on the things that work section. And you mentioned interacting with your users. Would you want to expound on that? Like what exactly do you mean interacting with users?
Yeah, so this one comes with a big asterisk. As developers, and I especially experienced this when I was working for Agilent, which is a gigantic company entirely of engineers, where you're a couple degrees removed from direct interaction with the customers who use your product, right? You're a developer who works on the back end. You're like, you deliver data to the front end developers, and the front end developers write the apps, but they don't even deal with the customers, right? The marketing deals with the customers. And so it can be hard to know really what people want and what their feelings are, right? I mean, just basically it just comes down to collecting feedback, whether that's soliciting it, whether that's just listening to what people are saying or observing, you know. But and again, I'm talking sort of, this is more of a qualitative thing, but if you have to make a decision about your product one way or another, you better ask the people who are using your product or find out how they feel about that thing, because I think there's a lot of value in that. Now, the asterisk is that works up to a point. I think that customer feedback should drive your decisions, but it shouldn't, or it should inform your decisions, but it shouldn't make them for you, right? A user might say, oh, okay, here's an example. A user says, oh, there's not enough contrast on your UI. It's too bright. Well, okay. I could be like, okay, and I could make everything, you know, super contrasty. But maybe that's really not what they're saying. They're not using the right terminology. What they're saying is, I'm having trouble finding things.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And so you got to work on a way to, okay, well, maybe I sort of divide it up a little differently. Maybe I add more white space, so it's actually less contrasty. You know, it makes it easier to pick things out. Maybe you do darken up the colors a little bit, but like, again, you have to kind of interpret your user's feedback. So
yeah, that's been something that's, I don't want to say a constant struggle at Design Collective, but it's something that is just always apparent. When we're providing customer support, it's a constant thing of trying to figure out what this person actually means. So it's like a message will come in and they'll be asking a question, and Paul and I will, I guess, like, if we're sitting next to each other, we kind of look at each other. I guess the equivalent in Slack is like eyeballs. or like the thinking face emoji, right? We'll send that to each other. Like, what does this actually mean? What are they actually trying to say? I think that example you gave, like, hey, this UI doesn't have enough contrast. They didn't necessarily mean color. They meant they were having a hard time actually finding out where the new stuff is. That's a very, very accurate report. Conceptually, like someone using a term that to you means something completely different than it means to them, right? And as a developer, we have to, there's like this translation layer that has to go on with marketing and sales. There's this translation layer that has to go on with like actual users and customers. It's always a thing. And it always, I want to say it makes me laugh more than it frustrates me, but I do get frustrated by it sometimes depending on the day. But I love that point because it just hits so close to home.
Yeah. It is very, very frustrating. Can take a lot of time. Sometimes you have to go back and forth with someone to actually understand what they're saying. And they're just trying to be helpful, right? They're trying to take the extra step and not only say, hey, this is wrong or this is broken, but they're offering a fix, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't always maybe know what the actual reason is or what the right fix is. So again, that's just the nature of it. So it's still valuable, but to a point, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's important to listen to that and not be isolated from it as a developer. You know, at a larger company, there's layers of people to deal with support, and you can sort of be, you get stuck in basically science lab mode where you're, you know, you're just kind of writing code into the void and doing projects that you're assigned without maybe understanding why.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, I guess along that point, you know, talking to people, talking to users and figuring out what would actually help them or why they're struggling with a certain thing. Specifically at Design Collective, one of the things that we wanted to do for a long time was upgrade our search engine, just make it a little bit smarter. And I talk about this one specifically because you mentioned Elasticsearch. So we try to collect a lot of anonymous data. We try not to equate that with people. We want to anonymize our data as much as possible. But when people commit searches, we can see like a search history, just for to see like, are people actually searching by room, or do they not search by room? Do they search by category more often than by room, or vice versa? Do they use tags at all? How often do people use colors versus materials, for example, you know, just kind of getting data, because we can use that data to drive design decisions. And so one of the things we wanted to do was look at, okay, how often are people misspelling words or using synonyms and not actually finding any content? So one hard example would be, someone might search for couch, but the industry term is sofa. Or more often in designer furniture, they will call it a sofa. So if someone searches for couch, they don't see anything because everything is tagged and listed as sofas, right? So that's an obvious limitation, and that's an obvious place where things can get better.
Now I have to think about what I actually call it.
A sofa or a couch?
I think I usually say couch.
I say couch too. But I would type sofa instinctually because I would see it 1,000 times a day. but yeah, there's like all these industry terms I never knew before about furniture industry specifically, that I didn't know. Like I wouldn't know what to call certain things. And Lindsay's like, oh, that's this, or that's actually called that, you know? And that was, anyway, so like those were some problems that we wanted to solve. And so we were looking around like, okay, how can we solve this problem? And solution A would be to invest more time into Postgres text search, which I technically think you can do stemming and synonyms and all that stuff. But another option was Elasticsearch, and Paul and I happen to be actually familiar with Elasticsearch. And another option on top of that was Apache Solr. And so for us, it made this real easy because on the tin, you can get stemming and synonym support with Elasticsearch pretty easily. And Paul and I already knew how to do that. So it kind of made this decision easy for us. And on top of that, looking into the future, I think this is maybe something I hadn't touched on yet, but especially if you're looking at making a decision that will impact your future infrastructure, your future offerings, it makes sense to kind of try to brainstorm, like maybe what are some things that we're going to be offering in the next couple of years? How does this interact with that? If it doesn't, you know, don't worry about it. But if it does, that's something you should consider. And so for us, we are looking at different ways of ranking products, looking at different ways of servicing products to users, looking at different ways of relating data. And for us, Elasticsearch, that's what its primary use case is. So again, it just made the decision easier for us, even though it meant adding another moving piece onto our stack, even though it meant having to worry about another server, worry about updating indexes when products change and all that stuff. It still made enough sense because Elasticsearch solved enough of our problems in an easy enough way. It made sense to go that route.
So if I were to distill that down into a soundbite, it would be something like design or decide based on what you're going to want, not what you want right now.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, within reason, right? Because, you know, what I want 10 years from now might not be what I want 2 years. You know, it's just like use
on an
common
infinite
sense,
time
I guess.
Scale. Yeah.
Right. But that was, and that's kind of a simplified example because the decision was easy for us. We already knew Elasticsearch. We'd worked with it in previous products, you know? But those were some of the things that we were still weighing. Like, does it make sense? So really, like, biggest thing wasn't, like, is Elasticsearch the right tool? It was, do we have enough time and energy as a developer team to bring in another moving piece and support that and make sure that server doesn't blow up and make sure that the index is, you know what I mean? Because now it's, like, changing data in the database. Now we have to worry about syncing that to another server, right? And syncing every single change back if it updates the search index. And then we had to figure out what does the search index really look like? Because now the data that goes back to the client doesn't actually have to look exactly like it looks like in the database. And so there, those were some of those, the questions and decisions that we had to make there. But ultimately, Elasticsearch did enough for us. We got enough out of it that it warranted the extra overhead of another server and all that.
Yeah, and your decision to even pursue that option is actually one of my other points here, is just gathering analytics and metrics, right? Again, going back to like having hard numbers to base things off of. In the case of, you know, business decisions like, oh, I want to improve search. Well, you had to gather data about what people are searching for. What kind of search results are they getting? Are the search results successful? Do they convert to sales? Right? Just having analytics on how your users behave. And not in a creepy way, right? It doesn't have to be, you know, like you said, they're all anonymized and everything, right?
Right. Yeah. I don't care what you are looking for specifically. I just, as a whole, I don't care what your tastes are personally, Rockwell. I'm sorry. I don't care what your tastes are in love seats and your other furniture tastes. I just want to know as a whole Are you getting meaningful results back?
I usually prefer just to sit in a cardboard box.
Like Bucky.
Yeah. But having analytics is just, it just really, really drives home your decision when you actually go to make the decision. It's really, really nice to have to back it up with numbers, whether you're proving it to yourself that you have to just, you know, decide on something or prove it to someone else. You want to have proof, and having real proof with real numbers is, it's hard to argue with that. I mean, you can't argue with that. I mean, maybe you can argue with how you interpret it, but you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, there's been a few situations where we had an assumption at Design Collective, and then we looked at the actual numbers because we were preparing to do a whole bunch of work, and we looked at the numbers and we're like, oh, never mind. We were wrong.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? The human mind is very, very susceptible to kind of seeing patterns that maybe don't exist.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that can be helpful if you're trying to improve performance for your application, you have to have metrics. You know, you have to have numbers, you have to have milliseconds, you have to know latencies, you have to have render times, you have to, you know how long your database is taking, CPU performance, RAM usage, right? I mean, you upgraded Nuxt and you had RAM metrics to see it, you know, instantly was improved. So that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. I really, really, really like this point, and I was looking at your notes, but I totally missed the analytics and metrics section because this has been maybe one of the places I've grown the most since joining Design Collective, and maybe one of the places I need to still grow the most since joining Design Collective, and that's really collecting, again, you know, not being creepy about it, but you have to have metrics. You have to know how are things working. And up to a point, it's really easy to get kind of into the flow of being a developer. And here's feature A. We got to roll out feature A. Okay, feature A is ready to go. It's out. Okay, now we're on feature B. Oh, here's a bug. Let's do that. You know what I mean? And kind of getting into that release cycle, just releasing. But it's been a big learning process for me, just how important it is to just sit back and observe and collect numbers and collect metrics and. Feature A rolls out, instead of rolling to feature B right away, make sure we're in a position to know if feature A was actually successful before rolling onto feature B, you know? And that's collecting numbers. Did it negatively impact performance somewhere? Did it positively impact performance somewhere? Are people actually using it? Do people see it? Do people use it how we thought they would? And then kind of going from there. And that's been really, really, really useful for us specifically, especially since we're a small team. The numbers, like you said, it's kind of hard to argue with them if you're interpreting them correctly. And in more than one case, looking at the numbers and collecting that information has saved Paul and I from losing weeks or months at a time on rebuilds or changes.
That's all really, really good points. And I'm glad to hear it's actually worked out for you. It's very, very powerful to have that you know,
yeah.
support.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Again, I don't know why I feel like I always have to like tag the, not in a creepy way, you know, onto any time I talk about analytics, but it is one of the most useful tools you have.
Yeah, you don't want to be taken the wrong way there.
Sure, yeah.
Just make sure you turn on your customer's webcam and record everything. Yeah.
I need to know emotionally, how are they feeling when they interact with this feature? On an emotional level, how does it impact them? No, I don't know. I'm glad you mentioned that point because that's something that I very rarely thought about when I first joined Design Collective. And now it's one of the things I think most about. And how can we actually know we're doing the right thing here? And really, at the end of the day, it comes down to money. You know, we're trying to grow slowly. We're purposely not taking funding and investment. So that our time needs to go more, like needs to go longer, right? And metrics in analytics directly allow us to know when we need to spend time on something and when we don't need to spend time on something.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the big tenets of, I think I mentioned this before, but the Lean Startup, the harps on that very, very much because it is so important when you're at an early stage like that to have data to make decisions on. It can make a big difference when you have to decide you have to pivot or anything like that.
Yeah. I'll make a note to talk about a service we're sort of migrating away from because the price just skyrocketed on it. And that could be an interesting conversation. Like deciding, do we need this thing? Is it really that important? Can we do something similar in-house just in a scaled down fashion, will it be as effective? And kind of what we found out about that. So
cool. I got a couple more points here, and then some also minus points for things to avoid. So when you're looking at options, when you're researching things, it's really, really easy to fall into the trap of only looking at the positive things. And I think I alluded to this before, but when you're learning about something, it's really, you're going to read a lot of marketing speak, right? Even open source projects, they're not making any money, but they still have to market themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, services and products, of course, have to market themselves. And you're only going to read the positive things. You're only going to, you know, the thing's going to, the research is going to be the next best thing since sliced bread, right? But of course, that's not always the case. It's not always, even if that is true, it might not even be a good fit for what you're doing. There might be trade-offs that you hadn't considered. So I always like to look at the negative things, right? Look at what maybe the size of the sort of community and support around this thing. Is it really small? Is the, what types of companies are using your thing that you're using? Are they high quality sort of documentation and community around that thing? Are there lots of issues on Stack Overflow, right? If you just search for a thing and look at problems that people are having, does it seem like there's lots of showstoppers for things that can't be fixed because the thing's not being supported? Maybe the people are just getting hung up on something that should be simple, but apparently is either not supported or really complex to set up. You got to know where the cracks are, and that you have to seek it out sometimes, because you're not going to find it just by going to the website of the thing that you're looking at. For example, when I was car shopping, right? You're going to read lots of reviews. I was shopping for a small and mid-size SUV. Mm-hmm. And the two top options were the Honda CR-V and the Mazda CX-5. And I had a CR-V before. It was great. I loved it. It was 2006, I believe. Anyway, I was researching new cars, and I ended up on carcomplaints.com, mm-hmm. which is this giant database of like all major issues that every car and brand is having, and it kind of ranks them and shows you what model years are bad and what engines are bad and what to expect. And it turned out the CR-V had the current generation had lots of these weird issues that like Honda was failing to even acknowledge, much less fix under warranty. Like they had this issue where basically if you ran the car when it was cold, like it has been the past week, there'd be a bunch of burning fuel would leak into your oil pan, and then like your entire car would smell like burning right. oil from the inside. And China like halted sales of the CR-V because Honda wasn't fixing it. And I was like, yeah, I really don't want to deal with that or have the chance of dealing with that. So yeah, I ended up with the CX-5.
This is a surprising amount of information for every complaint. This is wild. I've never seen this before.
Oh, it's great. It's really, really detailed. It's pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah.
It also makes you not want to buy any car ever.
Beware the clunker. High oil level with gas and oil. 2017 Honda CR-V, page 104.
Yep. Whew.
Well, I'll have to keep this. I haven't owned a car in, I want to say, like 6 years. So this is like so far from my radar. I'm going to have to bookmark this site.
So we've talked a lot about things that work, things you should look for. I want to talk a little bit about things that I've tried in the past that have not been so successful for making decisions about how to spend your time or your money. And the one that I keep coming back to, we talked about this on the show a lot, is just diving right into your work, picking a decision and jumping right in without thinking about it, without planning. That's just, you're just going to have a bad time. I mean, if you go with the first thing you find, again, it sounds like it could be a good idea, but you find out maybe it's not a good fit. You find out that it's not what you're trying to do is actually really hard or not supported. You generally don't want to just jump right in and do the first thing that comes to mind. You really gotta sleep on it. You gotta do some research. You gotta weigh the options.
Oh yeah.
And so many times I've gone down a road and ended up at a dead end, you know, and then that's just wasted time, wasted effort, just burns you out and you end up with nothing. And so that's just a really, really bad place to be. So I think the spending a little extra time up front is always, always going to be, even if it's just a little bit of time. You don't have to do all these things that we've talked about, obviously, but just slowing down and thinking and planning and staying ahead of whatever decision you're going to make is always going to be the right call in anything that you do, to be honest. This is applicable to life too, by the way.
Yeah.
So
I feel like you just called out past me pretty hard there. Pretty hard there. Yeah. Yeah. Continue.
No, yeah, this is all from personal experience. Don't take it as a personal shot there.
It felt personal.
And my last point here, that this is kind of a simple thing that I think a lot of people do and a lot of sort of decision-making project management tools support, is priorities. And this is more, I'm thinking about in terms of like specific like GitHub issues, you know, again, just how you're spending your time, what you're working on. Prioritizing things by like saying this is high priority, low priority, medium priority, extreme priority, right? Like priority zero. Yeah, that's such a bad thing to make decisions on, because you know what's going to happen. You're going to have 100 issues. You're going to have 100 different things you could be working on, and 50 of them are going to be low priority and stay low priority forever, because you're always going to have high priority things that are going to take the place of that, you know, the lower priority thing. And so the low priority thing could take you 1 hour, and it could have really, really, you know, big impact on what you're working on. It could be really, really beneficial, but yeah, if you never get to it, you'll never know. And it just clutters up your mind. It clutters up your inbox of things you have to do. You just end up with a graveyard of things. And I don't find that productive at all. I find that judging things based off of their difficulty has been much more sort of easing, and allows me to get through them actually much quicker.
Yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about that? Do you try to prioritize things officially, or do you just kind of have it in your mind, or do you, you know, what do you do?
Yeah, a lot of our priorities comes from above my level. So I guess it depends on like what we're doing, right? So if it's sort of like a brand new thing, that kind of comes down from the top. And then in terms of like prioritizing smaller steps in, that's kind of what we do in our, I think we mentioned last week in our Google Docs, how we kind of break the implementation details into 1 through X steps. And that's sort of how we prioritize things there. Because number one would be the thing that we're doing first. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's the highest priority. It's just that that's what needs to happen before something else gets done. And that could be even researching A, B, or C if it's a new solution or a new thing like Elasticsearch. So we don't really have any like regimented, strict way of prioritizing things. It's just kind of, most of the time in the situations we've been in with Design Collective specifically, it's been, well, this has to happen before that can happen, so it goes up in the stack. If that makes sense.
Oh yeah, and that's prioritizing in a totally different sense, right? I was thinking in terms of like importance.
Yeah.
But obviously prioritizing in terms of like time is something you have to do for sure.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, this isn't like a ultimatum, right? It's not like to say that you can't do it, but I think it's, if you only take that into account, if you only take the priority of a particular action into account, you're not going to get a lot done that you want to do, right? You're not going to get time to work on something again that might have really beneficial things. I mean, when we first started at Remote Ham Radio, like everything we did was a hardware-based solution. And one day, just for fun, I spent a couple hours and built something in WebRTC. It worked entirely in the browser, right? And that's 80% of our business now, right?
Right. Right.
So that might not have ever happened if I had constantly been fighting fires and working with our existing solution. So
yeah, that's true.
It's definitely a balance. Well, Ryan McDonough and everyone else, I hope this was instructive. It was actually fun to kind of rack my brain and go through all of my kind of experiences and projects and come up with some of these pitfalls and things that have worked, and it's really helped me. And I hope this has helped answer your question a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, he's been pretty active on Twitter with us, which we really appreciate. And we say this every week, but we really do appreciate feedback, questions, comments, just any sort of interaction. You know, we really appreciate it. We enjoy it. So yeah, keep those coming. Keep those questions coming.
Yeah, definitely. And maybe we'll feature your question or idea in a future show. If you want to send us things, you can reach us on Twitter at DNC Show. Sean's personal account is Sean Washbot, and I am Shruckwell.
Yeah, and if you're looking for the show notes, and if we've mentioned something specifically, I usually put those in the show notes, and you can get those at dnc.show, and you should definitely check that out. And we have a search there available too, so it's not like you have to go and find a specific episode to find the notes. You can search by topic, and you'll find relevant episodes that way as well.
We'll also post the show notes over at spectrum.chat, where we're hanging out. We have a couple people over there who have reached out to us and had some questions and some great discussions over there. So come check us out on spectrum.chat.
And if you're looking for a new job, you should head on over to spec.fm/jobs. They've always got some fresh job listings there. So if you're looking for something new, looking for greener grass, you should definitely head on over to spec.fm/jobs.
There's a new listing posted over there, assistant professor, tenure track, or assistant lecturer, non-tenure, in interactive media studies at Miami University, confusingly located in Oxford, Ohio. So that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think that's maybe the first non-tech specific, well, by tech specific, I mean like programmer, designer job that I've seen listed there.
Yeah, but you can imagine someone from the real world would have a lot of insight into sort of academic position like that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, as always, thanks to Spec for having us and hosting our show. And we really appreciate all the work they do for us and the community that they've allowed us to plug into. And we want to say a warm welcome to a new show on the Spec Network called Framework. And Framework is a podcast about the process of researching, planning, and building that goes into bringing a product to market. So kind of fits into the topic of today's episode, more on a grand scale. But yeah, welcome to the guys at Framework, Tom and Robert. We're happy to have you. And I think everyone should head on over there and check them out.
That's cool. It sounds like this episode, the show. This week's episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson.
I'm going to sleep so my body can recover.
Yeah, rest up and get rid of those sniffles, man.
I'm sorry about the noises, everybody.
It's all good. I hope you feel better.
All right, thanks.
See ya. Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Stop waiting for users to report errors. Iterate faster, improve customer happiness, and make a better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Check them out at Sentry.io.